Welcome to The Commercial Disco, a voyage of commercial discovery. This episode is proudly brought to you by CSIRO, Australia's National Science Agency and Innovation Catalyst. Explore the commercialization of great ideas across deep tech and science. Immerse yourself in conversations with the ambitious minds shaping Australia's unique innovation landscape. Discover their insights into what's needed to bring these remarkable ideas to life.
Hello and welcome to The Commercial Disco. I'm James Riley, Editorial Director at InnovationAus.com. The Commercial Disco is brought to you in partnership with the CSIRO, the National Science Agency. Today I'm talking to Professor Nicholas Opie, the founding director at Synchron, the brain-computer interface company, and head of vascular bionics laboratory at the University of Melbourne. Welcome, Nick.
Thanks for having me on, James.
Let's just start. Obviously, Synchron is very high profile in your area of science and has been for more than a decade. Talk us through your background at the University of Melbourne and then how you became engaged in this, what is effectively a commercialization of a very deep tech.
Thanks. We're having a lot of fun doing it, that's for sure. So my background, engineer in science. So I've always been fascinated by how things work, which is why I started doing science after finishing school, and also want to make things and have loved making things. And so that's where the engineering part came in. And I suppose the last decade or last couple of decades now has really been a fantastic time to put both of those passions together, where I can start making things that treat conditions of the human body. And in particular, I've chosen to work on the brain and the sensory organs. So I finished my degrees and then was lucky enough to work at the university doing a PhD on bionic eyes and trying to make a device that allowed people with rudimentary vision loss to have some type of vision to allow them to navigate around, not walk into posts, for example, or know where their knives and forks were, and ideally getting to a stage where they could recognize faces. So it's really where my journey began, doing a lot of research at making technology designed for implantation into humans. And I think from there, the company Synchron and the Vascular Bionics Laboratory at the University of Melbourne really started at the same time, where I was fortunate to meet another couple of individuals, Tom Oxley, who was a neurology registrar at the time, and we really got together and had this idea and decided we wanted to do the science on it, but also knew that to get the science out there to those that needed it, we had to have a company running alongside it. And so that sort of goes back to 2011, 2012, when that started, but certainly we've had a lot of fun since then. And before then, I really was able to find my calling in making these medical technologies.
So it's quite fascinating that you started off in that bionic eye project, I guess, at the University of Melbourne. And I remember at the time there was a lot of investment in that. There was a lot of emotional investment, dollar investment. It was really something. And then as part of that, this has moved on to a very specific part of what I imagine that bionic eye would have required.
I guess I learned a lot of things from the bionic eye, and certainly as a, I wasn't a director, I didn't have one of the big seats in that project, so there's a lot that would have gone on without my knowledge. But from where I was sitting, they had an amazing team, amazing technology, clinicians and researchers and scientists and engineers, and everyone was working together extremely well to get to a clinical trial, which I was lucky enough to be a part of. And then from my naive viewpoint, it didn't appear that there was a great way to move that forward and to turn it from an academic pursuit into a commercial sort of technology. And I think after leaving that project, that's where Tom and I really decided, based on that information, that, it's going to be expensive to get a technology out to the market. There's going to be things that we need to do that aren't going to be funded by conventional research grants. And that includes things like FDA testing, which is not scientifically interesting, but it's absolutely critical to getting a product proved and to be safe. And that's where we're going to need a lot of funding from investors, because the grants that are designed for new inventive science aren't going to cover it. And I think that's one of the lessons I learned from the Bionic Eye project, was really getting both of those pieces started at the same time and carrying them both through, because they do have different time points where they're critical.
So that in itself is fascinating. So we know that relatively early on in the piece, you attracted investments from Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos's investment vehicles, Arch Venture Partners, Coastal Ventures. You've raised more than $100 million Australian dollars. So talk me through when the very first kind of meeting or the first successful meeting where you've got outside money on board, outside of the kind of grants programs, but more of a commercial venture type relationship. How did it come about and how did it feel?
That came pretty late in the piece. It felt amazing, obviously, but Tom and I had spent years and years going around shaking the tin in for looking for investment. And at the time, this is sort of going back 2012, 13, those sort of years, the mindset of a lot of the Australian investors was different. There were a lot of groups that liked the technology, thought it was going to make it, but their timelines for their investments were 5 to 7 years before they needed to make a return. And for a technology that was as young as ours, we weren't going to be able to deliver that. And indeed, it's been 10 years and we still aren't selling devices because there's such a long regulatory requirement. So a lot of the conversations at the start were disappointing. And I think, you know, the environment's changed, but we were told a lot of the time, you're too early, we can't give you any funding. We were fortunate that because the technology was exciting, we were able to raise some grant funding. So we were able to keep the research going. We were able to continue to show that the device was safe and was functional. So we were able to do a lot of the early stage testing to show that the device worked and was functional and was safe. And really, it was only after or just before the first in-human trial where we were able to raise some private investment, which was much needed because, as I mentioned, there's a lot of activities that need to go on in a business that grants don't cover, such as paying for patents or paying for regulatory advice or legal advice, and these sort of corporate activities aren't funded by grants.
Okay, so let me ask you this. Elon tends to suck the oxygen out of the room when it comes to publicity on these things. He's obviously got a company called Neuralink that is doing similar brain computer interface. You started your first in-human trial, say, 2022?
No, we did a human trial in Australia starting in 2018, 2019. So the process for us was to do a first in-human trial in Australia, which we successfully completed a number of years ago with gentlemen with motor neurone disease. So these are people who have functioning brains, but are losing the ability to control their arms and legs and speech. And for them, the technology was designed to allow them to control computers with their minds to allow them to communicate with their loved ones and their carers and the community again. So we started quite early on in the piece, but I think it's great that there are a number of players in this field now, particularly the high profile one that you mentioned. It's great for the field. There's a lot of excitement around this area now, and often it takes someone with a bit of global swagger to encourage others to get excited about what they're working on.
It does seem like it's a huge area of focus right now for a bunch of companies and for a bunch of different reasons. Sorry, I must have been getting confused. I think you got FDA approval and there's a clinical trial underway in the US.
That's right. So we trial in Australia, and then to get approval to commercialize the technology for medical devices, the guidance we've been given is you can do a first in human trial in Australia. You then do a larger clinical trial in the US, which is an early feasibility trial. That then stems onto a pivotal trial, which is an even larger number of patients. And then on completion of that pivotal trial, you'll be granted approval, if it goes well, of course, by the FDA to sell the technology. You can then bring it back to Australia, you know, very easily and say, we've already got FDA approval. We've already done trials here. Can we sell it here as well? But that's sort of the pathway for a lot of med tech devices.
I have read somewhere that your market of people who would benefit greatly from this kind of technology is, you know, perhaps 100 million people worldwide. Is that the case? That's the number you're looking at?
I think technology like this has so many different uses and applications that the market can be extremely large. So paralysis, as you know, there's many different types and forms of it. It can be stroke, spinal cord injury, motor neurone disease. There's a number of reasons why people might have functioning brains, but some or even a part of their body is not working properly. And that goes all the way from people who are completely locked in and can't move anything other than their eyes, all the way down the spectrum to people with arthritis, for example, who might just have a lot of trouble using their hands, even though they're still there and they're still functioning to a degree. So, and that's only just the movement sort of disorder space. Technology like ours, where you can access the brain safely and get to pretty much anywhere in the brain you like, leads to a large number of other neurological applications, obviously like Parkinson's and epilepsy and depression, and the list keeps growing as more people are doing research, finding out how to treat these different conditions.
As a brain-computer interface, it obviously opens up a bunch of other things, perhaps industrial applications. Can you see an augmentation role for this kind of thing, or are you just focused on the medical tech?
I think all really successful medical technology gets to become a consumer good eventually, right? You see that with plastic surgery that was designed to help people with injuries or burns, and now it's being used, do you say, irresponsibly by those who just want to look a little bit different. And so it's really become a consumer product in that regard. And I think more time and energy is being spent on plastic surgery, not for medical conditions, for aesthetic reasons than otherwise. And certainly, I think if this technology becomes safe enough, then there may be a lot of people who are interested in using it for one way or other. That's certainly not our focus. That's not where we're going. We want to use it to help people with medical conditions. But, you know, I can't say that's the same for all the other players in the field.
Sure. Okay, so clinical trials right now, that pathway that you described before, I suppose it's a bit difficult to put a timeline on it, but have you got a guesstimate?
It depends a lot. So at the moment, we're at the stage where we've implanted all the participants we need to for the early feasibility trial. We have to run the trial on each participant for a year. All participants have either gone a year or at least 6 months. So we've got another little bit of time before the last patient completes their duration. And then next comes the pivotal trial. And the duration of that and why it's difficult to put a timeline on is it largely relates to the FDA's opinion of how this first trial's gone. And the reason there's differences is they might want to have 20 patients or 50 patients or 100 patients. They might want to see the trial go for 3 months or 12 months or 12 months plus 12 months follow-up. And depending on which combination that they seem to be the safest and most responsible to get a technology out there is the one that we'll have to go with. Now, fortunately, we've had amazing success, both safety and efficacy-wise. So we think that the FDA will see that favorably and say, okay, well, perhaps you don't need as many patients. Perhaps the timeline for this trial doesn't need to be as long. But we certainly don't have any confirmation from them at this stage on what that's going to be like.
Okay, I'm talking to Professor Nicholas Opie, the founding director at Synchron. I should have noted also, you were a winner of many prizes in your career, but last year's Innovation Oz Awards, you had Paul Shetland Disruptor of the Year Award for your work, which is where I met you.
Yep.
You must get approached by all sorts of young researchers or young startup types or people who've got deep tech aspirations. Do you have a kind of a stock answer when someone says, how can I commercialize my thing that I love? What do you talk to them about?
I think there's no stock answer. I think every product and technology is different. If you're related to a university, then the pathway might be different to if you're doing it on your own. But I think it certainly is very clear those that are excited about it and those that will be able to get it out there. It takes a lot of commitment. You have to be able to ride the very exciting times with the times that you're pulling your hair out because something's not working or you're waiting on funding or any other problem that you'll face, which is also the fun times, in my opinion. But a lot of resilience is required, and particularly in those early stage companies. I try and let them know that, it's a long journey. If that's what you're in for, then you'll love it, but it's not for everyone. And I think there's been some great conversations and some great teams that I'm working with who really are trying to push the needle on what's possible in the medical technology sphere at the moment.
So what's your typical week look like? You're obviously doing the research with the company. You're running the laboratory there at University of Melbourne. Do you have a split in your brain around commercial stuff and the research stuff, or the commercial stuff is handled elsewhere in the company and you just play on with the technical matters?
It's a bit of both. So when I look at a research problem now, I have a commercial thought behind it, some subconscious thoughts on, am I doing this technology? How can I make sure that it gets to the next stage? And I think that came during my PhD years where Department of Electrical Engineering at Melbourne University, and there were some amazing technologies that were developed by the other students. And often they would get to the end of their candidature and would leave and go do something else. And they've just left behind them this amazing technology, you know, for numerous different purposes. And I found it a little bit sad. Like, how come this isn't getting out? Like, you've spent years doing it. It's got the promise to help a whole lot of people. Why is it still there? And sure, like, different people might get tired of their project or what have you, but it just seemed a shame that a lot of this technology didn't get anywhere. So when I am looking at research projects now, whether it's sort of the ones I do or the groups that come to me, I automatically go, okay, well, where's the line we need to draw between doing this and that will be good enough to take it further, as opposed to getting stuck in the research sort of loop of continually trying to optimize and make something incrementally better and better, but never really pushing it out to those that they're making it for.
I mean, it's quite an unusual thought process, I would think, for someone in your position, or is it? I'm asking you, like, of your colleagues, do they run that kind of social impact / commercial viability filter on it?
No, I don't know if they do. And I think a lot of them that I've spoken to don't appreciate that they have all the tools they already need to be able to do the commercial side of things. I mean, these are incredibly smart people that are making, you know, a whole lot of different neural implants. They can do a company. Like, they've got all the skills, they've got the knowledge and intelligence. I think they just need the confidence and the approval to say, yeah, you can do it. You're not going against the university and the research. You're not going to the dark side if you start commercializing. It's just a pathway of this technology that you're making. I think historically there was a view that you could only do one or the other. You could only be in industry or in academia. And I don't see it that way. I think that you should be able to do both. And the industry part just follows on from the academic work, which is necessary to prove the technology in the early stages. And I think a lot of the ones I speak to, the reason they make something 90% and then try and make it 95% and then we'll spend more years trying to make it 97%, it's like they don't have the confidence they can then take it out. And perhaps they think it needs to be perfect, where that's not the case. The perfection comes sort of down the track and they just need to have the confidence in themselves to give it a go.
Yeah, it's amazing. So did you sort of go into your engineering degree and your undergraduate work, did you see a pathway that you thought, oh, maybe I think I would be more interested in industrial tech? Or did you see this, or is it just something like, as you've gone and you've sought different funding and you've got some private people on board, that your transformation evolved?
A bit of both. I think you do a PhD and you come to the end of it. At the start of the PhD, you've got these big plans and you're going to solve the world's problems with whatever you're researching. And then by the end of it, you look back and you go, ah, I didn't really do that. I didn't solve all the problems. So there's still all of this other stuff to do. So there's two ways you can go. You can either start fixing all the problems that you found, or you can say, okay, well, how can I go the next step and take whatever I've done and see how it goes in the real world? And I think there's ways to do both. And I think both are very important. And so perhaps it was during those years where it came to me that if I want to get something out and actually help the people that I'm making it for, that it's very rare that it can just be done in a university. Often it needs to be done through a company, or, you know, with a company, the uni tech transfer offices, or some other way to get the funding and marketing and what have you to take the product to the next step.
So let me ask you a question about markets now. Obviously, the US is an incredibly important market for you, and even the approvals process, I think it's so influential across the world. So how, and assuming a lot of your venture money has come from the US and the top companies in the US, is it possible to kind of run that effort from this country, or is in the work that you do that it's an inevitability that you would need to at some point be in the US?
When we were doing it, we had to go to the US, but I think that's changing. And some of the reasons for that are unique to our product and what we were developing. They didn't have the medical facilities to manufacture the technology here. You get to a stage, I used to make the devices by hand and then we could do some benchtop tests with them. If you're putting something in a human, you obviously have to get it done in an approved facility with quality controlled components and done in the right way and all that sort of stuff. And that just wasn't set up in Australia at the time. I think there's a lot of places that are starting to ramp that up, and I see a lot of companies in Australia now starting to do that themselves, having their own clean rooms, having their own manufacturing lines where they can manufacture products in Australia. But for us, one of the reasons we started off going overseas to the US in particular is because they had those facilities already. So we could work with them to get products that were suitable for human implantation. The funding is obviously another issue, as we sort of discussed, the view a decade ago from the Australian investors was a little bit safer, if you will. They didn't want to take the risks that some of the American investors had. And I think that's just a timing thing as well. Some of the American investors have taken risks, they've had great rewards, so they're more likely to take risks again, whereas the Australians perhaps are a little bit younger and haven't seen some of those big rewards give them the confidence to take the earlier bets yet. But that's changing. I think that's just a timing thing.
So I want to ask you, when we look at some of the newer funding programs, there's the National Reconstruction Fund, this obviously has a new CEO about to get underway, but we also have some very large programs, comparable countries. The US obviously has an Inflation Reduction Act, which is kind of pulling manufacturers into the US. So just talk me through, what does the funding future look like for you in terms of those kinds of options? Or are you now, you're on a private track and those programs aren't going to make a massive difference either way?
It's undecided, I think is the best answer. So the thing that is really amazing about Australia compared to any other country I've been is our sensibility when it comes to clinical trials and how good this country is at doing clinical trials. We obviously won't implant anything that's not safe, but we'll make sure that to get to a trial, you only need to do the tests that are safe. The FDA, while they are amazing, they are very rigid. You have to do these tests or you don't get to do the trial. And so there are times where, for example, you would have to do a test where you get a device and you put it on a shelf and you wait a year and then you test to see if the device still works after a year. Now, I can see why that's important if your device is going to be on a shelf that long, if you're selling a product or what have you, but if you're getting a device straight off the line and it's going straight into a person, as may be the case in the trial in Australia, then that test isn't necessary. And I think the ethics committees in Australia are very good at making sure that the devices are safe, but you don't have to spend all this time doing tests that you're going to have to do later anyway. And they're really focused on getting the best benefits to patients as fast as they can in the safest way, of course. So back to your question, is there scope here? I mean, I think a lot of the new technologies that the company is going to be developing will be coming back here, as other companies are, to be doing testing in Australia, doing the first in human trials. We've got a great relationship with the hospitals here and the clinicians. So yeah, we want to come back and do all these trials here. Can we also manufacture here as well? Well, that's starting to change. So that might be the case. But in terms of call it the first product, you know, we've got our manufacturing overseas. That's all quality controlled and sorted out. And for us to then move it somewhere else is red flags for the FDA. You have to redo a lot of the testing because you've already proven it safe there. So you have to prove it safe somewhere else. So perhaps not for that technology, but for the next ones, then yeah, we always keep our eye open for what's happening in Australia and find out ways we can take advantage of the ecosystem that's so amazing here.
I really appreciate the time. You're an absolute pioneer, not just in the technology, but in that deep tech commercial model. It's really quite amazing what you guys have done. I guess just to finish up, I just want to ask you, what's the next 5 years? You want to make a prediction on where you and where Synchron will be?
In 5 years, I'd love to see that our device has hit the market and that we're actually getting people outside of our clinical trials using it and having a lot of benefit over it. I think the field in general won't be too far behind. There'll be a number of other companies that are starting to do trials in Australia or in the US or even in Europe, looking at neurotechnology and the benefits of it. And I think it's going to be exciting. I think there's a lot of movement. There's a big groundswell happening towards this for, like I was saying, for movement disorders, for paralysis, but also for other conditions like epilepsy and Parkinson's. And there's a huge number of treatments that are coming out that aren't drugs and pharmaceuticals anymore, but technologies and devices. And it's an exciting space to watch. And if I could predict the future, I'd certainly be in a different spot than I am now. But I'm very excited to see what happens.
All right, Professor, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate you being on the Commercial Disco.
Thanks, James. Lovely to be here.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of the Commercial Disco podcast, proudly brought to you by CSIRO. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and leave a review wherever you heard us. For the latest on tech, innovation, and public policy, visit innovationaus.com. And stay connected with us on social media to ask questions or suggest future guests. Until next time, this is the Commercial Disco wishing you an inspired week ahead.